Kintsugi Heroes acknowledges funding and was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au.
Welcome to the Kintsugi Heroes podcast, where we share inspirational stories of everyday people going through different challenges and how they overcome them. Please be aware that the story you're about to hear may have moments of deeply felt emotions and personal experiences. If anything you hear has a triggering effect, please reach out to someone who can help keep you safe. If you love this conversation, we'd love you to like and share it with your friends so we can continue to share more inspiration and hope to as many people as possible. Now, listen up for our next hero story. This conversation is with Susan Bloom from a rural western town in the middle of the USA. Her story is a very detailed, harrowing account of an intense period of her life where she had children, a farm, a business. There was a lot going on and her husband got sick. She took me through the detailed steps of that journey and the struggles she had with the medical system and how they failed her and her husband and her family over and over again, how she had to use her own intuition and willpower. And then she herself was diagnosed with breast cancer on top of her husband's critical debilitating illness. It's very harrowing, but there was so much positive that came out of it, of course, and I was really grateful to Susan for sharing this. Enjoy this story with Susan Bloom. Hello, here we are. It's Kintsugi Heroes and I am with Susan Bloom. Welcome, Susan. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Aveline. I'm looking forward to visiting with you.
Wonderful. And can I ask, whereabouts are you in the world? Because that accent is not from my backyard.
No, it's not. I live in a small town in western Kansas called Oakley.
Wonderful. For those of us who don't know where that is in the US, is that kind of the middle?
It is. Kansas is pretty much the middle of the US.
Thank you. It's so lovely that technology brings us together. Well, how about we get started? I'll hand the mic over to you and ask you to take us back and begin your story where it begins.
Okay. So I was born here. My dad was a doctor here when I was 8 years old. His partner died suddenly, which left him as the only doctor in the county. I think at that point, the county had about 3,000 people in it. I never intended to stay here. I intended to go to college, get a degree, and go off to a city somewhere. And I met a local farmer after going to college for 2 years and being in a really bad relationship and coming home. And I met a local farmer, fell in love, and knew that I would be here the rest of my life because he would not leave. We married, I think I was 22 when we got married. We had three boys and moved around a little bit at first. He had a landlady who died, and so we moved down to my grandparents' farm about 45 miles south of here for about a year when our first son was born. And then we ended up coming back a little quicker than we could or thought we would. And he was asthmatic and chose to farm wheat, which was turned out to be his worst allergy. And when I think I was 29 and pregnant with our second child, about 8 months pregnant, I was in Texas with my mom picking up my nephew. And we got a call from my dad. He was in the hospital. He was okay, but he'd had a major asthma attack and stopped breathing. At that point, he did mostly quit harvesting and tried to not be out in the dust. But he was a wheat farmer and he wasn't going to quit doing that. So we went along, had a third child who's quite a bit younger than the other two. And 2012, he started having some symptoms, and my dad thought it was a sinus infection, so put him on some antibiotics, Dad was not practicing then because in 2001, he had slipped on the ice, hit his head, spent almost a month in ICU after practicing medicine for 2.5 days. They flew him to Denver in a blizzard, and where he spent almost a month in ICU and 6 or 7 months inpatient rehab because he had a stroke the next morning after surgery, brain bleed. And then he was, I think they were in Denver for about a year where he did outpatient rehab. And at that point, he quit practicing medicine because he never felt like he could think quick enough. So in 2012, like I said, Mike started having some symptoms. Dad thought it was a sinus infection, prescribed him some antibiotics. That was in August. In October, he went to see his healthcare provider, who also thought he had a sinus infection, and prescribed him more antibiotics. And in January, the 1st of January, like I think it was January 2nd, he went out to the farm and he couldn't see to come home. He thought he had something in his eye. He managed to, I think his vision came back enough that he could see, and he managed to get home. And the next day went to see an eye doctor and they prescribed something, and he went to see his healthcare provider and they prescribed more, and they just could not figure it out. And at the end of January, he went in to see his provider. His eyes were swollen, his ears were swollen, and his nose was swollen. At that point, his provider said, "There's nothing more we can do for you here. You need to go to Hayes, which is 90 miles. That's a regional medical center. And I suppose the population of Hayes is maybe 20,000, so it's not huge." And they put him in the hospital. Kind of an interesting side note, at that point, I didn't have a job, but I was getting ready to apply for the tourism job for the city of Oakley. And as they were admitting him to the hospital, I'm writing a cover letter and stuff and sent it in to apply for the job. I have no idea what the cover letter said. I was so distracted when I was writing it. We had that day also gone when they told us we needed to go to Hayes. Our youngest son was the only one living at home with us at that point, and he was 12 and in the sixth grade. So we went to the school and told him that we were going to Hayes, not really sure when we'd be back, not really sure what he needed to do after school, because at that point, my parents were also spending their winters in Texas to avoid the ice, which had caused Dad's accident. We said, "We'll call you and let you know what to do." And on the way to Hayes, called a friend and said, "Would you take him home?" Called the school and says, this is what John needs to do after school. And from that time forward, the poor kid didn't know if we were coming or going. I got the tourism job, which was full-time. We had been to Denver to see a rheumatologist, because he had been diagnosed with a really rare autoimmune disease called relapsing polychondritis, which is swelling of the cartilage. So we went to see a rheumatologist in Denver. He put him on some, you know, high-powered meds that they use for those things. But this disease was so rare, they didn't have the new biologicals, and those kinds of things weren't being used for it, mostly because patients would have to pay full price. The insurance wouldn't cover it because it hadn't been researched. And they put him on steroids, and that didn't help all that much. We played with the dosage, and it was kind of a mess. And then in January, he got his esophagus, his throat got really sore. It was hard for him to swallow, hard for him to eat. And so he had an EGD done. And the doctor came in after the EGD and he said, "Well, he doesn't have cancer." And I was like, "Oh, well, that was the farthest thing from my mind, was it the relapsing polychondritis that caused this throat problem?" Well, I don't know. So he sent us to Denver to another specialist. And again, they found nothing. Let's see, that was in January, and we kind of went on, and that got better on its own. And then he started getting anemic. So we went back to the the GI doctor, and he did another EGD and a colonoscopy to see if he was bleeding somewhere, which is common reason you get anemic. Everything was fine. And I looked at him and I said, what do we do from here? I said, we've been thinking about going to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. He said, I think that would be a good idea. So I think it was about a month later, it would have been the end of July, that we drove to Rochester, Minnesota. I think it was about a 10-hour drive because I worked for 2 days and then we drove in one day and had doctor. He had appointments on Thursday and then he had some on Friday too. And we took 2 days to get home. And I took the next Monday off of work. And I didn't realize it until Thursday. I was so tired. I basically don't know what happened at work those 2 days, Tuesday and Wednesday, until Thursday. And that's when I thought, well, I'm just emotionally dehydrated. My emotions are shot and I'm emotionally dehydrated. So the two doctors, he saw a hematologist there and he saw a rheumatologist there. I didn't know at the time the rheumatologist was one of a few doctors that specialize in relapsing polychondritis. And he told us of the 7 million patients they had seen at Rochester at Mayo Clinic, they'd had less than, I think, 400 cases of this disease. And he recommended a rheumatologist at KU Med Center that he had worked with. He'd been at Mayo Clinic before, and I think he's the head of rheumatology at KU Med Center, which is in Kansas City, Kansas. And that's where Dad went to school. So we were happy to be half the way to Mayo Clinic to see doctors. And we went to see them, I think it was in September. And then he wanted him to see a pulmonologist because of his lung issues. And we went to see him in October. And he looked at the CT that they'd done at Mayo Clinic and the radiologist report and listened to him. He said, I don't think we need to run another CT for 6 months, like the radiologist said. I think it would be overkill, which made total sense to us. And we said, okay, you know, came home. I think I stopped for we had regional tourism meetings. I think I stopped for a regional tourism meeting on the way home that day, brought him home. The next day, I went to another meeting that was about 100 miles away, and he called me. The meeting was done, and we were standing outside, and he said, I'm okay. I'm at the hospital in the clinic, and they're doing all this stuff. And I said, okay. He said, you don't need to rush. So I finished the conversation we're having and I came home. And when I got here, it was just a little after 5 o'clock. So the clinic was closed. So I went around to the hospital and I asked where my husband was. I forget. I kind of grew up in the hospital and the nurses used to all know me and they don't anymore. And I kind of forget that. And they said, well, who's your husband? And I told him. About that time, his provider walked around the corner and they said, well, there's Lynn. She'll know. So she said, well, have you seen him? I said, no, I just got here. And she took me into a room and she said, sit down. And she said, he has lung cancer and it's spread. And that's all I heard. She said other stuff, but that's all I heard. He has lung cancer and it's spread. Then she said, so take him home. And I'm like, take him home? Well, yeah, there's nothing we can do for him here. So take him home tonight. Okay. And then the next morning I'd gone to work. And before we even opened, he called and he said, Lynn called. She wants to fly me to KU Med Center. And he said, I told her that I wasn't flying. I said, okay. Have you talked to my dad? Not yet. Because Dad had seen the report, the chest CT that they did. And he kind of said, they can't diagnose from that. So then he called me back and he said, well, now she wants to just send me in an ambulance. And he said, I told her that if I need to go to KU Med Center, you can drive me. I said, okay. So Dad had an appointment with this provider later that morning and he said, have him come and we'll talk. The three of us will talk. She basically told him that if he would not follow her medical advice, he would no longer be her patient. And he said, okay. and left. So what ended up happening is my dad called one of his surgical friends, and they did a thoracentesis, which is they drained fluid from around his lungs, a lot of it. And then they set up an appointment with an oncologist at KU Med Center. And we went the next week and got this great oncologist. He was in his last few months of his fellowship. And he explained to us the difference between these two lung cancers. And he said, I'd like to have a bronchoscopy done. Can you spend the night? Because he knew where he lives, actually farther west. He grew up farther west than we live in Kansas. So we said, sure. And they did this bronchoscopy. And he said, and then come back the next week to get the results. Well, he called before we had left and said, you don't need to come back to get the results. They're negative for cancer. He said, I'm going to get with the rest of your team and we'll figure out the next steps. So the day we were supposed to go back was my birthday, which is November 18th. So right before the U.S. Thanksgiving. And we spent 6 out of the next 8 weeks going to KU Med Center, which is 350 miles, to try to find cancer. And they never did. And things progressed. I felt like they weren't figuring out the anemia thing because he'd had several blood transfusions. So I found the doctor at MD Anderson in Houston who had the most experience with what they had said it was. So we went down there and he did chemo down there for 3 months. Between every trip down there, my parents had a house down there because that's where they stayed in the winter times. So we didn't have to worry about that. But between every trip, we went to Kansas City to KU Med Center for something. And the throat condition had come back, or esophagus condition, because it was actually right above where his stomach was. And he could not, he could not get food down and he was in so much pain. And we had an appointment at KU Med Center. And he said, well, we're not going to go back there for that. And I said, yes, we are. You're in too much pain. And then I think it was that night that we spent 8 hours in an ER in Houston. I mean, they were trying to figure out what the pain was. We knew what it was, just trying to get some pain meds for him so he could get a little bit of rest. Went to KU Med Center. They put a stent in his esophagus and that worked for about a week and it slipped. And they had him as an add-on EGD. And I had gone out to an outer waiting room and I thought, you know, I think I should go back to that EG to the smaller waiting room. And about that time, the doctor came out and he looked at me and he said, I need to go get another surgeon. Okay. Then he came and he got me and he put me in a room and he said, he'll be in a minute. And a doctor who we had seen in the fall before when they were trying to find cancer in various places and said, well, after this test, what I was going to do is way too much. So we're not going to do anything. Came in and introduced himself. And I said, yes, we've met. Anyway, at that point, he had a hole in his esophagus. So the next steps were there's some special kind of a test that they do to see if it was leaking into his body because it could cause peritonitis. And he said, if that's the case, we're going to have to do surgery tonight. And it wasn't. His heart was blocking that hole, so nothing was getting out. So they didn't need to do surgery. And he was in the hospital for 2 weeks and at the end of that, they put a feeding, took the stent that had fallen down into his stomach out and put a feeding tube in. And he was in and out of that surgeon's ER, just having EGDs and dilations so many times in the next few years. I mean, we got to know him so well. And still, they couldn't ever figure it out, you know, what was going on. Then he was supposed to have surgery. They were going to take out part of his esophagus and so that he could eat normally. And he got sick right before he was supposed to have surgery. We'd gone and done all the pre-surgical workup and he got sick and they ended up hospitalizing him again, running test after test after test, put him on antibiotics because they didn't know what was going on and messed up his kidney functions. And when they did have a test result that they thought they knew what was going on, they couldn't give him the antibiotics they needed to because his kidney functions weren't wonky. They sent him home. They said, there's nothing more we can do here. They sent him here home on some antibiotics. He was in the hospital for almost 3 weeks that time and said, if the tests come back from the Mayo Clinic that it is, so what they had thought it might be was brucellosis, which is a cattle disease. And when I called my dad and told him about that, he said, you know, we talked about that in medical school, but in my years of practicing medicine, I never saw a case of it. And when they did decide that's what it was, they set it up so that we could do IV antibiotics for 7 days at our local, well, not our local hospital, but one that's about 20 miles away. And because his veins were shot, he'd blow his IV almost every day and they'd have to put a new one in. And I thought the antibiotics were going to kill him. He was so gray and so listless. And it was, this is going to be it. And it's the antibiotics. It's not nothing else. And he got through that. Where the feeding tube was, didn't really close very well. And so there was one summer that they moved it 3 or 4 times, and he'd have to come home with a wound vac on because the incision that they had made wouldn't close up properly. Or in September, I went and had my mammogram done, and they called and said, and I'd had it done at someplace new, they said, we need to see your last few mammograms. We're seeing something on here that doesn't look quite right. Okay. So I had probably an ultrasound done and then a biopsy done. And 10 days before my birthday that year, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, stage 1. So yeah, we were dealing with that too. I had a lumpectomy. The next day, Mike had an EGD in Kansas City. And when we went back for the results, it was the 22nd of December. And I saw the surgeon who said, well, you had it in 4 out of the 40 lymph nodes that we took out. So you've basically gone from stage 1 to stage 3, just that quickly. And she said, you will need to have chemo. It was questionable as to whether I would have to have chemo before that. So we went from there, and I was rather in shock, to Mike's surgeon, and Mike said, I want you to take the feeding tube out. And I thought, you know, that meant he'd go into like an OR. And he said, okay. He says, we'll do it right now. I said, wait a minute. Let me leave the room. I don't want to be here for that. And Mike said he pulled the tube out. And then we went to see my medical oncologist, who was, I think, in a hurry that day because it was the Friday before Christmas and it was in the afternoon, and she was ready to go home. And she was kind of abrupt with, well, here's what we're going to do for your chemo, and it's going to be much more invasive than the rest of it. Then about a month later, after I had the second surgery to take the lymph nodes out, he went in for an EGD and they wouldn't touch him because he had lost so much weight and was malnourished and dehydrated. And so he was on IV nutrition, and he took me to most of my chemo appointments. Sometimes we left after those to go to Kansas City because they were in Hayes, which is 90 miles, to go to Kansas City for various other appointments. And the Tuesday before my last treatment, he was in a lot of pain. So I took him over to the ER and they put him in the hospital. My dad took me to Hayes for chemo on Wednesday, and I went over there afterwards, and he seemed fine, a little grumpy, but he seemed fine. The next morning, I was getting ready to go over to see my primary care doctor, and they called from the hospital, and they said he started having trouble breathing during the night. At about 2 or 3 this morning, we put him on BiPAP. That seemed to ease it. About 6 or 7 this morning, we intubated him. And we're going to fly him to KU Med Center. And I said, okay. And she said, you have about 40 minutes to get over here before the flight crew gets here. So pack a bag and come over. So I did. My youngest son had just finished his junior year in high school. I asked him to drive me over to Colby so I didn't have to leave my Jeep over there. And I go in and I watched for an hour while they tried to stabilize him enough to put him on the airplane. And then the flight crew got there, and I watched for another hour as they tried to stabilize him to put him on the airplane. And on the airplane, I don't think we'd even reached cruising altitude when the monitor flatlined. And it's, I swear to you, it's just like it is on TV. And they started CPR, got his heartbeat back once, did it again, got his heartbeat back again. And the pilot said, "We are going to land in Hays. We're not going to Kansas City." So they took me, you know, took us off the plane, put us in an ambulance, took us to the hospital. And I was met at the door by the chaplain. And he took me to a private waiting room where I called my dad to tell him what was happening. And before, I mean, I hardly even had gotten in touch with him. The doctor came in, you know, at that point I knew he was gone. There'd been nothing else they could do for him. And we started making phone calls. One of the things that helped me to deal with this, I had found a program called, well, it's Touched by a Horse Equine Gestalt Coaching. And in the fall of 2015, when we'd been down to Houston so many times, I had used up all my vacation and sick time and had two people give me over 2 weeks of sick leave and had used it all up and had taken time off without pay. And they were going to combine my job with another job. And I said, no, I don't believe I want to do that. I already have two full-time jobs the way it is. Plus, I had like five horses at the time that I was taking. So in January of 2016, I started the Equine Gestalt Coaching program, and it heals emotional stuff so well. I think it truly put me in the best spot I could be to deal with losing Mike, to deal with having breast cancer. He died in June of 2018. Then my dad died in June of 2020. And since then, I've become a grandmother twice. So again, I feel like that program saved my sanity, not my life, but saved my sanity. Since then, I've completed that she has a second thing. So I am now a master equine gestaltist. I've had 4 years of intensive gestalt training, two of them with horses, two of them without. And now I'm off to start a new venture in eastern Kansas where there's more of a population, and I'm hoping to help doctors avoid burnout, help patients better, and some of those things.
Sorry for the interruption. This is Ian Westmoreland, the founder of Kintsugi Heroes, and thank you for listening to this story from one of our amazing heroes. Our mission is for these stories to provide hope and inspiration to people experiencing life challenges, and to also educate the broader community on how best to provide support. If you would like to help us continue to produce more hero stories and cover more adversity themes, we would welcome all donations. These can be made via our website, kintsugiheroes.com.au. The donate function is at the bottom of the homepage. We'd also welcome any feedback. You can email me direct using ian@kintsugiheroes.com.au. Now let's get back to the story.
What a detailed and emotional and tumultuous journey that you went on. And all the while, you never really had answers, did you?
No.
Mike just had things happening to him, symptoms, and it would have been pretty tough to deal with on top of everything else, holding down a job and then
studying. Yeah. I remember during that time, there were four holiday seasons that all I could think of was that I was grateful that my whole family was there, that he was there. And it was all I could do was to just be grateful he was there, especially that last one when he'd had the feeding tube pulled out a couple days before.
How many years was Mike's health journey from the moment he has had issues?
I usually say 5.5 years. If you add the couple months before when they thought he had sinus infections, it would be a little bit more than that. So for the first about 2 years of that, I was working a full-time job, and then I was doing the Equine Gestalt program. And we do in-person trainings, and I swear everyone I went to, I would say, I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it this time.
Sounds like that program, like you said, it saved your sanity. You know, you just don't know how much that did save you, but because of the connections of our mind, our hearts, our bodies. As you were telling the story and you were on the plane to go off to Kansas City and Mike's there and then he flatlined, my mind flicked back to something you said at the beginning, which is, I knew I'd spend the rest of my life there because he wasn't ever going to leave. And there he was refusing to leave. And that's the thing that came to me as you're telling the story. And it was like, I knew what you were going to say, because to me, it was like he didn't want to leave.
So in 2020, when I was in the Master Gestaltist program, we do what we call listening calls. And the gal, it's every day, it's supposed to be 15 to 20 minutes. And the gal I was listening with, she said she was supposed to be listening, not talking. And she said, I don't know if I should say this right now. So the other day I was out in my shop and I felt a presence. She said, it was very definitely male. And he said, I did not set her free so she could spend the rest of her life in Western Kansas. It's taken me a long time to get this move made, and I had to sell his land to do it.
What a beautiful gift.
Yeah. There were a couple other, and my sons all say, Mom, that's all BS. They're just telling you what you want to hear. I said, okay, you think whatever you want to think.
How did your youngest son cope with that? Because obviously through his teenage years, you guys were in and out of hospitals and medical centers.
Yeah, right. Through his formative years, from the time he was 12 till he was 17, his dad died before his senior year in high school. I think it was really hard on him. He started having seizures in May of 2021, and I honestly think that's part of it, that they're emotionally triggered. And because it seems like when he gets real high in emotion, his body just seizes up. He says, no, I can't handle it, and seizes up. So much so that I took him to Hawaii to work with a colleague of mine who also does somatic body work. And, you know, I think it may have helped. He needs more work, but it was hard on him in this small school where, you know, everyone was involved with their own stuff and they really didn't know what was going on. And I know there was a woman, well, she was our veterinarian, who died in September of what was his senior year, and her oldest daughter, it was her freshman year. And he said, none of my classmates treated me the way everyone is treating her. And I had to remind him that his dad died in the middle of the summer, and they were not thinking about that. And he's such a kind soul. He went to this girl that he hardly knew and said, you know, if I can be of any help to you, I would be glad to help.
That's a reflection of, you know, how he's been raised. What a beautiful boy.
He is. The night I was diagnosed with the breast cancer, he was in the fall play. He did the play every year. And their performances were on Saturday night and Monday night. And I was diagnosed on Friday. So Mike and I just talked about it and said, we won't say anything to him until he's through with these performances. And so a couple nights later, I said, so I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And the first thing that came out of his mouth was, so there's a bigger chance I'll have cancer later in life, which kind of hit me like, well, that was unusual. And then I thought about it a little bit, and it was, for his age, it was exactly the response he should have had. Because when kids are 15 to 17, they're in an age of appropriate narcissism where it's all about them. So I was glad for that Gestalt training so that I could kind of take a step back and say, oh, that's right. And then the next thing he said was, Mom, you know, when I tell Grandma I'm going to bed when I'm over at their house, I get in my pickup and I come home and sleep in my own bed. Okay, I'm not sure what I want to do with that either. And we talked it over. And so, I mean, my parents lived just a few blocks away, so it wasn't like he was too far and said, okay, whatever you need to do.
Did you have other people or anything else that helped you through those 5 years and especially going through your own breast cancer journey?
You know, not as I've seen. There was a younger woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer after I was, and she and I talked quite a bit, and they set up this, or she also had a double mastectomy, and they set up this, well, we'll bring your family meals and this like tree to do that. And I don't know, I've always felt like kind of an outsider here, even though I was born here. So my support was basically my parents, my children, and Mike. And I did have a couple of friends. Mike had a couple of times he couldn't take me to chemo. A couple of women that I had gone to high school with, and we'd been in Bell Choir at church since we were teenagers, took me. I had a massage therapist who I started seeing about the time I was diagnosed. She offered to take me if I mean, I hardly knew her. She offered to take me if I needed someone too. And it has amazed me when they have said, well, you're such an inspiration. I'm like, I'm just doing what I have to do to get through this and try to get him through it. And yeah, we had also seen a therapist, and I went to see him a couple of times in that. And I remember telling him, I'm not tired and afraid. I'm exhausted and terrified. And one of the things that was hardest for me was to be the strong one, because I was being strong for his sister and for my parents and for my children and for him. Until I found the equine gestalt program, there was no one that I could go to and be vulnerable and be, you know, not be the strong one, because everyone in town would ask me about him. When my dad was in the hospital the first time, I could go to the grocery store. It would take 3 hours. Because people would stop me, and I was going to college in Hayes. So I would go to the grocery store in Hayes because I didn't want to deal with the people here. And it was almost the same with Mike, because he's an extrovert. Was a really high extrovert. So if he wasn't related to someone, he knew them and would talk to them. And his mom used to say, well, he'd never met a stranger, which is probably true. So everyone asked about him. And of course, not until I was diagnosed with breast cancer did they ask about me.
It's interesting how people around us are affected and respond in different ways, but it's often they're all in their own little worlds. What I like hearing from your journey is, of course, that you found something that helped you. It gave you sanity, but it probably gave you that emotional healing that you needed. And looking at you today, you exude this peace and this gentleness and this calm. And obviously there's a lot of gratitude there, and you're about to embark on this new journey, which is very exciting for you, probably daunting, but also exciting.
It is daunting, very daunting.
Thank you. I've got a final question for you, Susan. For listeners that are listening to this story and who might be going through something similar that you went through and that may relate to part of your story, is there something that you would like to share with them?
If you're caregiving for someone else, you need to take care of yourself sometimes first. I think one of the best things that I did for myself was I drove 40 miles morning and night when he was in the hospital to stay with my son in Lawrence, about 40 miles away, to take myself out of the hospital. And I would try to be over there in the mornings in time for early rounds, which were at 6 or 6:30. But that was my way of taking care of myself, was not trying to sleep at the hospital, which is hard to do, and taking care of yourself, because you cannot take care of someone else if you don't take care of yourself first. And one of the things I would like to do once I get to Eastern Kansas is to do some groups for caregivers to help them do that self-care.
Perfect. And I can see how that is really important and very needed. So it's wonderful that you're able to now give that back. Thank you, Susan. Thank you for sharing your story in such a beautiful, authentic way today.
Thank you for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Kintsugi Heroes. Please like and share the show to your friends so we can get this out to even more people. If you have a story you'd like to share with us, please reach out using the contact details below. And join us next week for our next Heroes story. Until then, keep being you, and remember that we are all heroes in our own unique way.
Only when it's broken. Only when you're broken. Only when you're broken.